This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Following the December 7, 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. military launched a secret program to recruit young female college graduates to serve as codebreakers in the war effort. In Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II, journalist and author Liza Mundy reveals the achievements and the patriotic service of these remarkable women. She recently spoke with me about the women who broke the codes used by the Germans and Japanese during World War II. Liza, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So how many women served as codebreakers during World War II?
Well, at least 10,000 women served, and I suspect as many as 15,000. There were two enormous code-breaking operations at work in Washington, D.C. One was run by the U.S. Army. The other was run by the Navy. There was also a very secret project that was happening in Ohio, in Dayton, Ohio. There were women helping to build and then ultimately run the machines that would break the codes of the U-boats in the Atlantic Ocean, and that was happening in Ohio. So it was an enormous female code-breaking workforce.
Was the one in Ohio, was that the one associated with NCR?
Exactly, yes. We were building the, they were called bomb machines, B-O-M-B-E, that were being used to break the Enigma codes that the German Admiral Dönitz used to communicate with his submarine commanders. And it was women who were wiring the rotors in Dayton at NCR, and then women, the same women, were sent to Washington along with the machines. And it was the women who ran the machines and broke those Atlantic U-boat codes.
How much of a cross-section of the country did the women codebreakers represent?
That's a great question. Initially, women were recruited by the Army and the Navy were ferociously competing for educated women or simply smart and apt and loyal women who could keep a secret. The Navy started out recruiting from the elite women's colleges along the northeastern seaboard. Smith, Wellesley, Radcliffe, women there would receive secret invitations to meeting with professors. They would be asked, do you like crossword puzzles and are you engaged to be married? And the right answer to the first was yes, and the right answer to the second was no, and they would be recruited by the Navy. The Army, meanwhile, was recruiting school teachers throughout the South and the Midwest. They were looking for educated women, and pretty much the only job available to an educated woman back then was teaching school, and many of these school teachers were very low paid and were eager to find new work. So, but as the women proved what they could do, the recruiting operations really spread throughout the country. So women were coming from the West Coast, they were coming from the Midwest, and they were coming from the South and the Northeast, really from all over the country.
So they were looking for highly educated women. What particular skills? Were they looking for math skills, science skills, that kind of thing?
That's a great question. Code breaking actually benefits from somebody who has a facility for both math and languages, because there's many of these were numerical codes. Particular words like Maru, which was the Japanese word for a commercial ship carrying supplies, that would be converted to a numerical code group, and then another set of numbers would be added to that group, and that would be transmitted. So there was math that had to be done to subtract out the number that had been added and get down to the initial code group. So it helped to have women with a facility with math, but it also helped to have a sense of language and where in a sentence certain words are likely to appear. So they were really looking for women with a liberal arts education that embraced both of those. But, you know, only 4% of American women had attended college in the 1940s. And so the services were also very eager and willing to give aptitude tests and to find women who were bright. And in some cases, these were women who were actresses or, you know, had barely had a high school education, and they happened to be smart and apt and maybe good at crossword puzzles. So they were seeking talent and aptitude and willingness really wherever they could find it.
Dot Braden is at the heart of the story about the code-breaking women. Tell us about Dot.
Yes, Dot was the oldest of four children. She grew up in Depression era southwestern Virginia, where, as it happens, I'm also from. She had gone to Randolph-Macon Woman's College, which still exists, although it's now called Randolph College and it's coeducational. Her mom had sent her to college because her mom was supporting their family as a secretary, and she wanted Dot to have the benefit of a college education to be able to support herself if she needed to. And Dot was teaching at a public high school in Chatham, Virginia. She was completely overwhelmed. It was her first year of teaching. She had no experience. All the male teachers had shipped out for the war. Many of the female teachers had left to marry the men. She was teaching physics, French, English, hygiene. She was marching the senior girls, and she was completely overwhelmed. She was being paid $900 a year. She went home and told her mother, I just can't do that again. And her mother had heard that there was a Army recruiter set up for recruiting for some kind of government work at a hotel in their hometown of Lynchburg, Virginia. So Dot, she went, she applied for the job. She didn't know what it was. Her background was thoroughly checked. She got on the train out of Lynchburg with two suitcases and an umbrella and a raincoat, and she came to Washington, D.C. with no idea what she'd been hired to do. And within a couple of weeks, she was breaking Japanese codes that would be used to sink Japanese supply ships throughout the Pacific Ocean. So she was one of many, many, many school teachers who were literally sinking ships.
Much of this, Liza, is forgotten history, and a lot of it was highly secret. So how did you track the stories of these women?
Yes, it, just as you say, that, you know, the women were told they were absolutely sworn to secrecy. They couldn't tell anybody what they were doing during the war, but they were also told not to tell anybody what they had done even after the war. And so many decades have obviously passed since World War II. I used every means I could to track down and find these women. The Army and Navy code-breaking operations ultimately merged into what is now the NSA, the National Security Agency, which is our eavesdropping and surveillance agency, because that's what the women were doing during the war. They were doing eavesdropping and surveillance and hacking and cybersecurity. So the NSA knew of a couple of women they put me in touch with. I also went to the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and found rosters from during the war with names of many, many women. Often these were maiden names, so it took some detective work to try and figure out what their married names were. And then I cold called a lot of women. And, you know, if I called a dozen women, often 11 of them would have passed away by now. But that one woman would answer the phone, or she would call me back and be very eager to talk about our wartime service, because the women at this point, they really would like recognition for their enormous contribution to winning the war.
How did the extended secrecy of their work, how did this affect them on a personal level?
That is a great question. You know, this work was very stressful during the war. It was a great opportunity to come to Washington and to leave small towns, but they understood very clearly while they were doing the work that if they made a mistake, you know, that lives could be lost, or that lives that would have been saved might not be saved. So it was very hard and stressful work. They were doing it 24 hours a day on three different shifts during a 24-hour period. And so it was exhausting and stressful. And then after the war, they couldn't talk about it. And some of the women I interviewed, their adult children, who did feel like their mothers had a form of PTSD after the war, that it was really that stressful. And also in many cases, the women left the work and you know, went on, as they were urged to do after the war, to have children and be housewives, and couldn't talk about it, even as their husbands often were talking about their own war service. So it was, I think, a complicated set of feelings. The women were proud of what they had done, but they were also stressed out by it, unable to talk about it, unable to get credit. And I think that it was hard on them that way.
How significant were they in the code-breaking effort? I mean, what were their major accomplishments during World War II?
There were so many accomplishments. I mean, we talked a little bit about the Dayton women and the role that they played in building and running the code-breaking machines for the Enigma. And eliminating the U-boat menace from the Atlantic Ocean. So those, the group of women that worked on the German naval codes really did help drive the U-boats out of the Atlantic Ocean. You know, they saved many of our convoys who were bringing troops and supplies to Europe. They cleared the Atlantic Ocean for the enormous convoys that were bringing men to the D-Day invasion. And the women were running those machines and breaking the messages during and after D-Day. So they were reading messages from the Germans describing the Normandy landings. There was also a group of women who created fake dummy traffic, U.S. military traffic, to convince the Germans and deceive the Germans that there was a group of American troops that were poised to make a landing in a different part of France. So they successfully fooled the Germans into thinking that if the Allies did invade France, they would invade in the Pas-de-Calais region as opposed to Normandy. And that was an important and successful deception operation. So an enormous amount of important work going on in the Atlantic. Meanwhile, in the Pacific, the women working for the Navy were breaking the Great Fleet Code that the Japanese Navy used. That code-breaking effort was responsible for the enormous victory in the Battle of Midway, which is one of the most famous sea battles of all time. The Americans prevailed, although they were outnumbered and the Japanese were planning to ambush them. And that was a real code-breaking victory. And then a year later, they broke the naval code that gave them the itinerary of Admiral Yamamoto, who had masterminded the Pearl Harbor attack. And his plane was shot down and he was killed as a result of that code-breaking effort. But also, I mentioned these school teachers who were sinking ships. The Japanese army, of course, occupied so many Pacific islands, and they had to be supplied by ship. And because the army school teachers were breaking those shipping codes, the troops and supplies and spare parts didn't reach those islands. The ships were sunk, and the Japanese army was not able to resupply itself. And that had an enormous consequence on winning the Pacific War.
I'm talking with Liza Mundy. She's the author of Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. And Liza, any thoughts on what would have happened had the U.S. not broken the Japanese and German codes?
Yeah, that sort of counterfactual is really devastating to even think about. World War II was a war of signals. It was a war in which armies and navies were spread out all over the globe, and commanders and also political officials and government officials were all communicating by radio signal. And so it was a massive effort to hack into those signals and learn not only what militaries were planning to do and where ships were going to be in these massive oceans, that was so important, but also what political leaders were, what kind of strategies they were hatching. One of the major code-breaking efforts, which was done by a woman, was breaking into what the purple machine that the Japanese diplomats stationed in Europe were using to communicate with in Tokyo. And obviously, these Japanese diplomats were communicating with Hitler, they were communicating with Mussolini, and all sorts of European Axis leaders talking back to Tokyo about what they were hearing in Europe. We were reading all those messages, and so we were also privy to the strategizing that was going on between Germany and Japan. So it's really unimaginable what would have happened if we had not broken all these different code systems.
Why do you think these women's contributions to code breaking remained an untold story for such a long time?
Two reasons. The women themselves were very, very conscientious about keeping this secret. They were told that they couldn't talk about what they did. They were told that they must tell people that they were secretaries, that they were emptying waste baskets and filling ink wells. They were very conscientious women, and they kept that secret for decades and decades. But I think also, even after many of these records were declassified and made available in the National Archives, historians really did overlook their contribution or assume that it was unimportant, because the records are there, and they have been there for several decades now in the archives. And when I was reading histories of code breaking during the war, historians would sometimes say, literally in a parenthetical, "Oh, by the way, most of this work was done by women." But they wouldn't interview the women or really write about those contributions. And I think only now, as a result of movies like Hidden Figures, which was first a book, and other books like Rise of the Rocket Girls that really talk about women's STEM contributions, their early contributions to the computer industry and to the war, I think really sort of only now are people receptive to the fact that women were there at the beginning of any number of these fields. So I feel like it's a good time to be getting these stories out there.
Liza, you mentioned PTSD. What were some of the other challenges that a lot of these women faced after the war?
Well, after the war, they were told, thanks very much for your service. It's time now to go home and have babies and start a family. And really, I mean, there were propaganda films made by the government encouraging women to get out of the workforce and make the jobs available to men. So the women who had joined the Navy were eligible for GI benefits, and in some cases applied for graduate school. One woman applied, she wanted to be an architect, and she applied to architecture schools, and she was told, oh, we don't have any places available for women. We are saving them all for men returning from the war. And even when she said, well, look, I served in the U.S. Navy, she was told, well, that's too bad. We're still going to make them available to men. And this particular woman had sunk a Japanese convoy, and she knew that she had done that. And she couldn't say anything about it. She couldn't say to the architecture schools, look, I contributed in a really significant way. And she was shut out of getting a graduate degree in architecture. And other women, I think, found themselves very isolated after the war, although, of course, they were happy to get back to normal life and get married and have children. Suddenly, they were living in very small apartments. There weren't very many appliances available after the war because all the American industry had gone to producing, tanks and airplanes. So the housework was very, very difficult after the war. It was hard to find housing. And so they went from being a sort of a collective group doing this important productive work to being very isolated in their homes with, wringing out bed sheets in bathtubs.
How much of an impact do you think the code-breaking women had on the feminist movement, Liza?
Question. Some of these women were able to attend graduate school and go on to careers in academia, and a number of the women stayed with the code-breaking effort and actually became an important early generation at the NSA in the intelligence community in Washington. So although they haven't been acknowledged, they really were pioneers in the field and the ones who were able to stay in, and I think their presence did make an impact in the post-war period and really paved the way for the feminist movement and women's more whole-scale entry into the workforce in the 1970s. But I must say also, I talked to adult children who were very impacted by their mothers, in some cases, unhappiness after the war, to have lost this opportunity to be productive in the workplace. And one woman said, I felt like my mother seeded feminism in our household because she wasn't able to work again after the war, and it made her unhappy. And, this woman said, my father said to me, your mother is the sort of person who really should have been working all her life. And it made her daughter very determined to get an education and take advantage of opportunities. So I think it was a complex but pretty profound impact on the women of later generations.
Liza, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Liza Mundy. Her new book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II.